Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name is Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where I ask my guests to reveal the five little things from their life that they would be happy to see preserved in a time capsule. Well, actually, they pick four things they want to preserve because they treasure them, but they also have to pick one thing they would like to banish from their life, something they'd be happy to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in this episode is the presenter, broadcaster, and comedy writer, Clive Anderson. Winner of the British Comedy Award in 1991, Clive began his success during his 15-year law career with stand-up comedy and script writing before rising to fame as the host of Whose Line Is It Anyway on radio and then television. Clive went on to front 10 series of his own show, Clive Anderson Talks Back on Channel 4, and 4 series of Clive Anderson All Talk on BBC One. He's made many guest appearances on shows such as Have I Got News For You, QI, Mock the Week, and The Unbelievable Truth. Clive has been the unflappable host of live events and award ceremonies for BAFTA, the London Evening Standard Film Awards, the Chortle Awards, and the Oliviers. In recent years, he's presented The Big Read and Maestro on BBC Two. Clive hosted Whose Line Is It Anyway? Live at the Adelphi Theatre in London in 2015. Due to popular demand, the sold-out show returned to the London Palladium in 2016 and again to the Royal Albert Hall in December 2018 to celebrate its 30th birthday. Clive took his first solo show, Me, Macbeth and I, to the Edinburgh Fringe in 2019 to critical acclaim and a sold-out run. And a debut tour across the UK is planned, when it's possible. Clive continues to present Loose Ends and Unreliable Evidence for BBC Radio 4, but he's rarely the interviewee, as he is now. I hope you enjoy it. So, Clive, thank you so much for being part of My Time Capsule, my podcast. And it's you must be fed up with podcasts.
I've done one or two all the time. But this is the way forward, apparently.
I suppose so. But not only are you on them, but then you have to interview people about them every week.
Yes. Well, I do Loose Ends on Radio 4, and that's, for good reason or bad, is generally interviewing people with something out. And it's a film, a book, a TV series, a play on in the West End or elsewhere in the country. And of course, as you know, as an actor, plays have all come to an end. So there's nobody with new play productions. There's one or two films still coming up, but they're going to dry up soon. Even books, people don't necessarily want to publish. But thus, you know, restless people at home say, oh, I know, I'll do a podcast.
Yeah.
So I've got quite a few. Twiggy's got a podcast. I interviewed her trail. So it's tea with Twiggy. So as though they were having meeting up, yes, having a cup of tea. And
well, that's sort of what we're doing.
Yes, we can't pretend we don't know each other.
No, quite. No, we're sort of having tea with friends. Mm. But in fact, we're talking about five things that you would like to put into a time capsule, yeah, from your life.
Mm.
So what's your first item?
Well, I thought I'd set off, first of all, it's a football. It's a particular football.
Yeah.
It was one given to me by my grandparents when I was a little boy. I can't say exactly the age that I would have been, but very, very young. When people have often asked me over the years, what's your first memory? I've always replied, it's going on a sleeper train to Scotland to see my grandparents. I spent a lot of time going to Scotland when I was young,
yeah,
holidays, but also to see my grandparents, and then they died. So it was a sort of succession of things.
Mm.
And But I've now begun to doubt my own memory, because I don't know why we would ever have gone on a sleeper. We always had a car, rather grotty old car, which trudged up the road and took ages and ages to get there. I don't know why we would ever have gone on a sleeper. And I didn't really check this out with my own parents before they died. I've been sort of rabbiting on about this. But definitely getting this football is one of my first memories. And I'm fascinated by what you remember, what you don't remember. So I can remember getting the football, and it was a proper football made out of leather. And I don't know how interested you are in football, Mike, but...
Well, I am quite interested, okay, yes, and, you know, I'm sort of about the same age as you, so I sort of know the football you're talking about, the sort of dubbing football.
Yes, it's a leather football, and inside it was a sort of bladder. I don't think it was made out of a pig's bladder anymore, maybe sort of just rubber. And I was fascinated by the inner workings of this, and I can remember getting the football, and I can remember I could take you now to the bedroom that it was over Christmas, so I was sleeping, yeah, in my parents' bedroom with my sister rather than in my ordinary tiny little bedroom, because we had lots of family there. Anyway, this football, I can remember getting it. I can't really remember playing football beforehand, but I must have been playing football beforehand to have been so excited by it. And yeah, I can't remember ever using it, because we used to play in the park. I used to wander off when I was from quite a young age. And it rather depended what sort of ball you had at any given time. Normally it was a plasticky thing called a Frido or a Frido Wembley, which you could kick and it went for miles. Or sometimes you had a proper leather ball. So he must have used it for that. And a thought lodged in my memory must have been the time when I lost it or it burst or the first time I played with it. But it all links up with my memory. Football has been part of my life. And as I say, I used to go to Scotland a lot to see these my grandparents.
Were you ever shipped off to your grandparents? Did you go off to your grandparents on your own ever?
No, but I spent quite a lot of time. My grandfather came to stay with us when my grandmother was ill, or I broke a leg or something. So that was an early memory. Then we'd go and see them a few times. They had a smallish property, smallish sort of flat, really, in the Isle of Bute, which is in the Firth of Clyde, a little village out of the way there. And they'd moved there sometime before from a bigger house in Glasgow, quite a big house in Glasgow, I think. And as far as I understand it from my parents, they'd just taken everything they ever owned from that house in huge removal vans and then crammed it into this flat. So it was full of interesting stuff, because my grandfather had been to South America, which is quite exotic in those days, and he had things on the wall, you know, made out of old snakes and crocodiles and alligators. And he had loads and loads of clocks as well. But when he died and then my grandmother died, my parents didn't know what to do with any of this stuff, because it was impossible to sort of... because a lot of people go and live on islands like that and they retire. So it's loads and loads of this stuff becomes available. But I was a bit cross. I wanted to take everything, you know, not take everything, but, you know, to keep all these exciting things. The only thing I got really was a few books, because he was a publisher, so he had lots and lots of books. I managed to hang on to a few of those, and a clock. Which one of his many clocks I held onto, and I've still got.
You've still got it?
I've still got it, yeah.
What sort of clock is it? Is it sort
Sort of spins round on a... I don't know why I'm indicating this is a podcast, but I'm indicating to you, Mike, it twirls round, and it's every now and then it needs repairing. He did have a sort of grandfather clock, which I know we left there because it was just too big to move, and cuckoo clocks and all sorts of things. I found this all very fascinating.
Yeah, of course.
My parents, I think, regarded it as a load of clutter that they weren't interested in the slightest.
Well, I think maybe that's often the way, in fact, that when you go to clear out your parents' stuff.
Mm.
You've known it all your life and it's been there and you regard it all as rather worthless.
Yes.
One or two things you might want to keep because you think they're precious, but not many things.
Yeah. I'll tell you another, this is slightly off the subject of this football, but my father was in the RAF during the war and he also did some stuff with sort of cadet forces afterwards. So he had, when he died a few years ago now, still got his RAF uniform hanging in his cupboard.
Yeah.
So I, along with a load of other stuff, I had that from him and I looked at it and I thought, well, am I going to keep this RAF uniform? I have no actual use for it. And I thought, oh, no, there's no point in me hanging on to this. I've got loads of stuff. So I gave it away to a charity shop. And about a week later, I was appearing on a show. I had only a short-lived show on ITV, fronted by Paul Merton, called, I can't even remember the name of the show now. It was an improvisation show. The idea is you turned up and you'd had no notification of what you were going to do, but you were suddenly thrust into a scene. So Paul Merton introduced it and there were some actors ready to act out the scene with you.
Mm.
And I was to play an RAF officer and I was given an RAF outfit to wear. For all I know, it was his RAF outfit because they might have, the way these TV things work, they might have gone to the charity shop and bought it a week before. But perhaps that was a bit unlikely. But I thought, this is ridiculous. So there must be some karma or something telling me that I maybe should or should not have disposed of this. And I couldn't even play it like him. He was Scottish and had a reasonably strong Scottish accent, but that's not what you want when you're playing a typical RAF officer. You had to be jolly chocks away kind of thing, which is how I play it.
Were you about the same size? Would it have fitted you?
Fairly similar, yes. I'd been doing a show talking about his kilt, which I inherited, and I could never quite grasp that he could have worn the kilt that he had hanging his but I used to wear it for being on stage and Burns Nights and things. And then a few years went by when I didn't wear it and I'd had to dig it out again for a Burns Nights supper that I was going to go and address. And I couldn't get into it. And so I had grown from, he and I, both are very, very skinny boys and young men. But in the sort of, I don't know, few years, maybe 10 years at most, probably as a result of getting married or something, I acquired his... I still have his middle-aged shape.
The only way to fit into a proper uniform is to buy one from a general or a major or someone who would have been slightly elderly if you get to our age, because, in fact, all uniforms are worn by young men.
Yes, it's no good. Anyway, they got me a right-size uniform for the TV programme.
So you don't actually remember playing football then with this football?
Not particularly that football. What I do remember is that, and football has been, so I think suitable for this time capsule, I've played football, I've watched football. I play football every week, badly and slowly. And I used to play obviously as a kid.
I thought you were a midfield general. Isn't that what they call it?
I'm not really.
You stand in the middle and don't move.
I certainly don't move around very much. I tend to stand near the goal, a sort of goal hangery position, or sometimes I hang around the defence. But I'm you get to be so slow when you get beyond the years properly playing that so trying to dribble past somebody is no longer possible. Dribbling past somebody involves just taking the ball to them and giving it to them, and trying to tackle somebody, I find, I do a perfect tackle in just half a second after they've left. So it may or may not look good. It certainly doesn't get in the way of the attacker.
You don't play a full pitch still, do you?
No, we play indoors on an indoor pitch. So it's a bit bigger than five a side, but we do once a year play on a full-size pitch in Italy. We have a tour. We go to Italy and play two matches in the course of the weekend, and that is...
Is it Angus's club, Angus Deaton's club?
Angus plays in it as well, yes. We're a sort of group of people, except when we go to Italy, when we play against an elderly-ish village side.
Yes.
We just play amongst ourselves, so we just balance out two teams.
Remind me of the name. Is it the Strollers?
Strollers, that's right.
Strollers.
Yeah.
People are always arguing that I'm a member of the Strollers because I did once play.
Oh, if you played, then you are technically a stroller. Once you've played as a stroller, you're a... You are still a stroller.
But this would have been in about 1985.
Well, I would, yes. I think that's roughly when we started. And right. We're still going, I was going to say we're going strong. We're going weak in my case. But you're definitely a stroller. I don't know what that entitled. You could probably come to the Christmas dinner if you wanted to. You
wow, mean. I might well do.
Yes.
I've always been rather envious, actually. Then maybe I will. I'm going to come. I'm going to stroll in as if I have the right.
Well, it's only really useful for doing, you know, little quiz questions with each other. Which stroller has got a knighthood, or which stroller has been in prison? You know, those sort of questions. And there's usually somebody we can come up with who's. What would your unique quality be? Which stroller has a podcast involving a time capsule?
Yes, which stroller hasn't played since 1985? I think would be the question. Every single time I try to play football, I just pull muscles left, right, and centre. It's no good. So
right.
I'm no good. I'm not even good as a midfield general, I'm afraid, anymore.
All right. I think I play well within myself, which tries to avoid pulling any muscles by hardly using any of them. But it's like if there's like a cone on the pitch. So if somebody could hit my leg and it goes in the goal, that's a goal for me. I'm the goal scorer.
Yeah, no, that's a triumph. That's something to talk about
happen.
For weeks. So this ball, which would have been, I think, you know, a leather ball for a five-year-old boy, is,
yes.
You know, it's a lovely thing to receive. But I'm sure the first time you kicked it, you thought, oh, my goodness, this is heavy.
Well, there weren't, if you remember the way your way balls were in those days, they weren't too heavy the very first time. It's just that if you kicked it around on a wet day or wet grass, it would absorb water.
Yes.
And it got heavier and heavier. And, you know, we played football at school, a bit older than that maybe, you know, up to age 11. And you still had to head the ball, even though it was a heavy ball. I think they're worrying about this now, as it may cause, you know, injury.
Yes.
Whether it's better to head a light ball, I don't know, because it's still going to have a force to it. Let's not worry too much about
Let's
these.
Let's not worry about that.
Because I've had, as I say, a lifetime of jollity and interest, either, you know, looking at football matches or playing in them.
You've been a lifelong Arsenal fan, is that
right? Yes. Yes. And, you know, there's been some downs and ups, ups and downs in the... It's not fantastic at the moment, but... we've had some good times.
Yes.
For the first few years that he followed when I was introduced to Arsenal, they didn't win anything at all. They were a really nondescript team. And I'm afraid my memories go right back to the 60s.
Mm.
And Arsenal didn't win anything until right at the end, or just it became the 70s, and won the double, you know, the cup and the league. And the
Charlie
league.
George.
Yeah. I bump into him from time to time.
Do you really? Has he got bad eyesight?
He has got better.
That's all that heading of the ball.
So I live in Highbury, and I think he does still. So he's a great example of just how it ought to be, that you're a local lad, you've got a prodigious talent, precocious talent in his case, and he was a bit wild, I think, in his youth and his playing days, but he's not wild anymore. He's Mr. Nice Guy now.
Lovely. All right, well, let's take that football then.
Okay.
And we're going to preserve it. I'll put some dubbing in. Just
okay.
In case it's a rainy day, so we can protect it.
Thank you very much.
And we'll put it into the time capsule.
Yes.
So lovely, that's your first item.
Yeah.
Right, what's your second item?
Well, I thought the next thing to do... now, admittedly, see, I haven't got this football anymore. It's a notional football. And I'd like to put my barrister's wig in the time capsule as well. I haven't actually got that either anymore. But I'm sure with the facilities of the podcast, you could re-equip me either... find it for me, get it back for me, or, you know, equip me with another one.
I don't insist on things actually existing. I'm sure we can find them and put it in the time capsule.
Yeah, but as people I know who aren't involved in the law, and I would recommend trying not to get involved in the law, at least not as a customer or a client or a defendant or a litigant, you know, you're vaguely aware that people wear odd things in court, and... at least in criminal courts, barristers still wear a wig and the judges wear a wig, though they're not quite the wigs that people sometimes assume you wear, because I'm sure you've been in sketches and plays and dramas and things, and the judge wears a wig down to his shoulders, and so does the barrister. But that's not what the barristers or judges wear in a courtroom. It's a little wig that perches on the top of your head in each case. Those long bottom wigs are just for the formal time when perhaps you're made into a judge or you become a QC. And so people get the idea, well, that's what they wear. And they're a bit disappointed sometimes when they go to see the Court of Appeal or something and the judges are wearing these little wigs. You think, well, have we come on a dull day? Where's the proper foliage they don't wear? Anyway, as a barrister, you have very special clothes you have to wear in court. We're quite weird, really. I mean, they're odder even than people perhaps realise. So you wear all black with a white stiff collar.
A wing collar, in fact.
It's a wing collar, yeah. And a wig and a special gown. So it's unlike any other profession or academic gown. It's even got a little sort of bag thing attached to the shoulder of the barrister's gown and then a tape coming down the front, which might link up with the bag or might not. Nobody's quite sure if it should do or not. And nobody really knows what that's doing there. What's that on the gown for?
Bribery?
Well, yes, almost. One theory is that barristers, when they appeared in court, were gentlemen and they weren't tradesmen. And so they didn't expect to render a bill to the solicitor who would be briefing them or the client or something. So they would just have this little bag over their shoulder into which could be tucked some amount of money that could be given to them. That's one theory why this bag might exist. Another theory is that wigs were a bit longer when they first wore them and had they'd be sort of oiled or greased. And the bag was to sort of have the sort of dangly bits of the wig enclosed in there to keep you from mucking up your clothing.
I actually studied law.
Yes.
I don't know if you knew that about me.
I think I did know that, but I'm aware that not everybody listening will know.
No, it's just, I've never quite sure whether I've told you or not. But I studied law, and I did work for a year before I went to university, well, as a solicitor's clerk, I think, but went to the Old Bailey regularly. The thing I remember about it, the barristers, was that they carried those wigs in a black metal box.
Yes.
With a gold trim to it.
Yeah.
Did you have one of those?
I did. Oddly enough, I had a leather version of that. I can't remember why I decided to go with that. I thought it'd be lighter and less. But I know my wig, I was very disappointed with once I had it. To be a barrister, you have to be a member of what's called an Inn of Court. Mm. Middle Temple, Inner Temple, Gray's Inn, Lincoln's Inn. And there's a ceremony to become a barrister. You're called to the bar to be a barrister. You have to do that. Mm. And in the Middle Temple, you do that while dressed as a barrister. So you wear a wig and gown. It doesn't apply to the other Inns of Court necessarily. So I was about to be called to the bar with a couple of days to spare, and I had realised in my usual incompetent way, I hadn't really thought about getting myself a wig. Well, there's a proper place you go to, Eden Ravenscroft, and they measure your head and they design your wig to fit you exactly. But it was way too late to do that, so I'll just borrow somebody else's. But a friend of mine said, oh, there's a place around the corner, they sell you, it's off the peg wig. So I went in there, oh yeah, we can do much cheaper, and I wasn't really concentrating what they were telling me. They were basically giving me or selling me a lightweight kind of summer wig that wouldn't be too, which is fine. It was quite an interesting idea. But when I realised, it just didn't look quite good enough. It looked like a rather cheap version. So I was, I wouldn't have minded sort of somehow losing it and having to replace it with a better one. But of course, if you don't mind losing something, you never do. So
no. But I always thought that the status of a barrister was judged by how worn their wig was. In fact, quite often, because it's sort of a family profession, quite often you would inherit your own father's wig.
Yes, I didn't have the long tradition in my family of distinguished lawyers, I'm afraid. Most people buy one, but it starts off looking quite white and it gets a bit greyer looking and sort of older looking, and that gives you an indication of your seniority.
And you never got to QC?
I didn't get that far, I'm afraid, and my wig didn't ever really get very old looking. So I did quite a lot of years, maybe 14 years as a barrister. It was quite a long, long enough for it to enter my soul, as it were, and to make me the person I was.
Yes. And so at the same time as being a barrister, you were basically also working as a warm-up man, weren't you?
Well, yes, I did sort of things on the side in comedy, quite a small way, really, for a long while. So I did a bit of stand-up comedy at the sort of Comedy Store and places like that. And I used to write jokes for sketch shows and bits and pieces. And on the back of that, I got asked to do the warm-up. Say, a show like Last Smith and Jones, Griff Rhys Jones and Mel Smith. I wrote quite a bit on that. And then I do the warm-up. And I think I was a better warm-up person who keeps the studio audience happy or genned up, especially in the sketch show, there's lots of gaps. So it's quite a... It's not a job that most people like, but I quite liked it. Mm. And as I say, I think I was better at that than actually doing the proper creative work of writing the material.
What about as a barrister? What sort of law did you practice?
Well, I mostly did crime, which is not the most highfalutin area of the law. It's probably what people think of when you say you're a barrister. You go, oh yeah, you represent, you know, in jury trials and things like that. But in fact, the people who make the real money at the bar do, you know, tax disputes or land law or equity. You know, crime is... I found it the most fun to do and interesting to do, but it's almost entirely publicly funded. Therefore, the fees are not just, you don't just think of a figure and charge it. You're given whatever the government feels it can afford on paying for things like that. And I understand from my friends at the criminal bar, it's almost impossible to make a living out
of it. Yes, it's got worse.
You can sort of understand it. If a government's trying to cut down on spending, if they say, well, we're not going to build another hospital, there's a riot. If you say, well, we're not spending so much on getting criminals represented in court, and barristers and lawyers are not going to get so much money, nobody's marching on Downing Street. Occasionally, I think barristers have recently, but nobody joins in. Nobody's, what do we want? More money for lawyers. When do we want it? Well, take as long as they normally do to answer a letter. 6 months, probably.
6 months to pay.
So it's tough, but I had a sort of double life for a bit, doing, you know, as you say, studio warm-ups, bit of writing, bit of stand-up comedy.
My father was a criminal lawyer.
Yeah, did he ever brief me when I was needing it?
I don't think he did, no.
I think you warned him off me.
He never mentioned it.
No.
He worked entirely in criminal law, but always in defence.
Yes.
But my father did some very interesting cases over the years. He wrote the brief for Lord Hutchinson, Jeremy Hutchinson, for the Christine Keeler defence.
Oh, right.
In her perjury trial.
Yes.
It was recently sort of dramatised on television, and I noticed that in those circumstances, the solicitor was completely cut from the whole process.
It's the trouble. I suppose it applies to anything that you know anything about, but courtroom scenes and legal scenes are always wrong, in an irritating way. So, you know, if the fact that there might be an absolute requirement for the solicitor to be there, we haven't got time to have that. We'll just, you know, cut him out. Well, it's old Bailey, we know what that looks like. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, but we've got a cheap, like, another court that we'll use that.
It's a council office, I know.
And the barristers, an American film, you go up and stand in front of the witness and harangue, we want that bit. No, barristers don't do that in this country. They stay where they are. Yes, they do. They do. We've seen it in thousands of scenes. Yeah, because always you just copy what you've seen in an American film, which goodness only knows if it actually happens in America as well, but it certainly doesn't happen in an English courtroom.
No. I have occasionally played a barrister, strangely enough, once with Paul Merton, who you mentioned earlier.
Oh, right.
Yes. In his Gordon and Simpson series, I played a barrister in that.
In the Hancock one, Magna Carta.
Yeah, 12 Angry Men.
Yeah, did she die?
Yeah, that famous word. It starts in the court.
Yes.
People forget that you think it's mostly in the jury room, but actually it starts in the court, and I played the barrister in that.
Right.
And I did have to say to them, I'm sorry, but I'm a junior, and this is a QC's wig. And everybody looked at me as if I was such an arse.
There was a TV series on not long ago, and the plot of the whole series depended upon the victims in the case deciding to ask the prosecuting barrister to come out of retirement because they wanted her to prosecute the criminal case. And somebody must have said, well, victims and witnesses in cases don't get to choose the prosecuting. Everyone knows that, so that can't work. And then somebody else said, yeah, but we've written it now. We've booked some expensive actress to play the part.
Isn't that off on the way?
Can I make a boast? Because this reminds me of something we were talking about before we started. I do have the last letter ever written by John Profumo before he died.
Really?
It was. is that exciting? Is that an exciting thing?
It does excite me. I mean, having made the mistakes he made,
yes.
He then led a life which was quite extraordinary, wasn't it? He worked almost entirely for charity for years and years, didn't he?
Yes, he was very interested in a charity in the East End of London, and it just lodged in my mind because unusually, I don't know how, maybe my wife had got up and the post had come early, so she came up and I had a letter which I'd opened in bed. I don't very often do this, and I opened it and it was from John Profumo.
No, you don't want to be in bed with John Profumo.
I was in bed. And so while I was opening it, Radio 4 was on and the news was coming and John Profumo has died. The family. So he ran a charity, or he was the sort of the notional head of a charity in the East End of London. Mm. And rather confusingly, they asked me to give a lecture. And I thought, oh God, I've got to write a lecture. Then when I got there, I realized they didn't really want a lecture. They wanted me to do some manky old jokes the way I would have normally done that. But anyway, I did it in the end. But the letter was from him saying, oh, I'm so pleased you've agreed to whatever the letter was. Mm. So I must try and find that letter in case I ever need to show an interesting object.
Well, while we're on the subject of last things and podcasts, I sent a message to Danny Baker today because one of the things he does is a podcast where he's up in a treehouse, talking as if he's talking to his mates, and he puts out little tweets asking for things, and today he asked, can anybody claim they were the first to do anything? I was able to tell him that I was the first actor to speak Shakespeare on the Globe stage when it was rebuilt.
What part were you playing?
I wasn't playing a part. I was filming something nearby, and we were constantly disturbed by the hammering as they laid the planks on the stage at the Globe.
Yes.
And I wandered in and they stopped hammering. Mm. And I said, is it finished? And the fellow said, yeah, sorry to disturb you, mate. I said, no, it's all right. It's all right. Do you mind if I walk on it?
Mm.
So I climbed up onto the stage and I then did a speech from Hamlet.
What, the rest is silence?
And no, I did How All Occasions Do Inform Against Me and Spur My Dull Revenge.
Oh, wow.
And at the end of it, these blokes with their belts and their hammers and everything gave me a polite round of applause. And one bloke said, very nice, mate. So I was the first person to walk on the stage, first person to say Shakespeare.
Yeah, I would think that would be magnificent because your beautiful actory voice would carry to the back of the auditorium. It's a good thing. I was very dubious about it when they were going to, oh, we're going to reconstruct something very nearly on the site of the Globe. Mm. And they'll use it. But in fact, once it was done, it's fantastic.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like all theatres, under threat, I think.
Oh, really?
It may disappear.
Well, yes.
Yeah, we're a sad loss if these things go, because the buildings will stay, but the whole structure underneath it needs funding. It's one of the great quandaries we're going through at the moment. France, they seem to have decided that it's worth funding the arts, and I think they've set up a fund that will keep the arts going until next August, completely funded.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because they say it would be, like Winston Churchill said, when they said we need to cut the arts budget during the Second World War, and he said, well, what are we fighting for, if not to keep the theatres open? There you are, that's my Winston Churchill.
I think you should be doing that on the stage of the Globe.
Enough of my rambling. So we're going to take your barrister's wig. I shall put it into a leather box for you.
Yeah.
And we shall put it into the time capsule.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay, so we've done two, so we've got three more.
Yes.
So what's your next one? We're going to take a short break here for some adverts. We'll be back with Clive very soon.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for waiting. Right, let's get back to Clive Anderson and find out what else he'd like to put in his time capsule.
Now, my next thing, I'd like to take a tree. Is there room in the time capsule for a tree?
Yes, it's as large as you need it to be.
Well, I suppose I could just take an acorn, because that would take up less space.
You've got time.
And I don't know where the time capsule is going to be, but if it could just have a little crack in it that the acorn could force itself out, we will eventually get an oak tree.
Yeah.
So I'd like a tree because I have a long-standing interest in trees, and for quite a few years I've been president of the Woodland Trust. Mm-hmm. So I've advocated on behalf of trees up and down the country. So in part of the attraction of getting people interested in trees, kids quite like growing trees, but also old people, because people like to think, oh, I could plant some trees here, and although I'll never see them, or not in their full glory, I can imagine, you know, even on my deathbed, I can be thinking in 100 years' time, this will be a forest or an avenue of trees or some shading around these fields. I think that's the frame of mind perhaps I'm in for wanting to take a tree, or at least an acorn that'll grow into a tree.
But I think it's true of almost anybody who plants a tree. You're never going to see it really come to fruition. Mm. But it is a charming thing, isn't it?
Yes.
The idea of saying, one day this will look like this.
Yeah.
My father-in-law insisted that he would see his trees grow to fruition, even though he had cancer at the time when he was planting them. I think it was a sort of a ray of hope for him.
Oh, right, yeah.
I'm going to stay. I'm going to bloody stay and see these things. But if you look at sort of things like Capability Brown, to see the glory of those things in 200 years' time, it's a marvellous thing, isn't
it? Yes, it's a sort of artwork requiring time to bring it off. But just planting an area with trees in it without any particular design, other than you can still imagine the forest of the future, or hope for it at any rate.
They're extraordinary things as well, aren't they, forests and woods?
Mm.
And we're only really, I think, just learning about them now.
Well, yes, the thing about them is they only really sort of grow to their full potential after perhaps hundreds of years. Mm. So the only term you can really use is ancient woods, which in this country you can say, well, if trees have been growing on the same spot for 400 years, the records up before that are too inaccurate. Mm. You can't say for certain it's a wild wood that's always been there. But if it's been there for 400 years, it will have acquired a whole ecosystem of funguses and interlocking plants and things. So sometimes, sadly, there is a need to chop down an ancient woodland because somebody has to have a railway or a road or an airport or whatever it is. And usually these days, the relevant government agency will say, well, never mind, although we're going to chop down that ancient wood, we will plant some trees further over, more trees. And you think, well, that's quite good. That's a bit good, but it's going to take hundreds of years to get back to what you've lost. And that's just in this country. But then you look at the world, when sort of Brazil or Indonesia or West Africa, and you're chopping down trees that have been there for hundreds of years, you're going to make a bit of a profit. Maybe you're going to turn it into grassland for cows. It's not doing the planet any good in the long run.
No. And they'll never really be those same sort of woods again, will they?
No. I mean,
because they'll plant conifers or something. You know?
Yes, well, some trees don't really come back. Even it's quite hard to get oak trees to germinate in this country now. They get a mildew, so they can, if it's a nice sunny area, they can turn into oak trees, just naturally, just wild on their own. But within a wood, it's quite hard for them to do that now. They get too mildewy. So it's, and there's quite a lot of diseases. Anyway, I don't want to be despondent about trees.
No. I mean, they were marvellous things. My wife, just today, I was walking in woodland, and my wife pointed out to me a thing called a mother tree.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what it was. But she said that in the midst of all these oaks was one huge oak.
Yeah.
And she said that's the mother tree. And it actually feeds the saplings and helps to spread the fungus. And
yeah, there's quite a lot of work has been done about this underground root systems. And I mean, some of it sounds a bit fanciful when you first hear it. They sort of warn each other of impending insect arrivals. I'm not sure how how scientific that is. But I'll tell you how I became president of the Woodland Trust.
Do, yes.
I was on a programme on the television called Ready, Steady, Cook. Or celebrity Ready, Steady, Cook. I think my agent insisted upon that. They did a short series of people, you know, off other programmes to come on and do Ready, Steady, Cook.
I'm not just cooking. I'm not going to bloody just cook. I'm going on as a celebrity, thank you.
Well, it's an odd programme. I think it's been brought back. And it's one of these programmes that succeeds in spite itself. So the idea of it is two people compete and they're given, or they have a budget of £20, I think it was, of ingredients. And then you, before the studio audience, you cook a meal and you're against each other. So it's either the one signalled by the red pepper or the green pepper wins.
Yes.
Now, the odd thing about it is the audience judges which is the better dish, but they don't get to taste it. So it's done in real time. So I can't remember how long the show is, maybe half an hour, maybe three quarters of an hour. You come in saying you've bought the ingredients. I mean, it's not exactly a fiddle. They just make sure you don't go above the £20, but they buy the ingredients for £20. Mm. So they keep within your limit. And you don't even cook the food because you're assisted by a chef who's there. In my case, it was Ainsley Harriott. So as I assisted by, so he basically, oh, Kai, hello, good to see you. And he cooked the thing with me sort of, you know, handing him things and doing some mundane things. But this, because it was a celebrity thing, you didn't win any money or a prize or anything. You won some money for your charity you were going to nominate. Mm-hmm. So my becoming president of Woodland Trust depends upon me winning this particular episode. And I was up against Gregor Fisher, yeah. You know.
Yes. Rabsy Nesbitt.
So he was cooking on his side of the thing, and I was cooking on mine. And you go out of the studio for a bit and somewhere, then you come back in again, and they're about to vote. And Fern Britton was presenting at the time, and she asks you if you bring something in of your own, something in addition that you cook. So I brought some marmalade in, because I make marmalade most years, and she wasn't quite certain of that, because it would taste a bit soapy, and I think somebody had washed the jar because it was a bit too sticky. I said, well, this, my fabulous... oh, no, I'm losing it on the marmalade. And then they said, oh, and so they are, well, Gregor, what have you brought in? He said, well, I've brought some potatoes in from my own garden. And she said, oh, you grew those yourself. And he had a flash of honesty came over him and said, oh, no, my gardener did.
Oh.
And it's Rabsy Nesbitt's got a gardener. The audience, which was a London audience, admitted, took against him. At that point, I think he was winning on the basis that my marmalade was soapy at that point. But no,
yeah.
He's got a gardener, Rabsy Nesbitt. And so then they came to it, I won, and I had to say which charity. Now, usually people have, they've got a story to tell, fair enough, about a relative or they go for a children's hospital or something like that. And I just thought, some charities never win out on these things, and I'm so keen on trees, I'll say the Woodland Trust. And they're like, oh, all right. So, but the Woodland Trust, the guy running it at the time, saw that, and he said, he got in contact. He said, well, if you're so keen on the Woodland Trust, you could be our president. And I said, well, that'd be great. Am I not replacing somebody? He said, oh, no, it's an important role. I said, well, who am I replacing? Well, we've never had a president before. We survived without a president. But we could make you the president. So I suppose he should have just said, come and be a known supporter or something. But anyway, yeah. So I've been there ever since. So I'm sure there'll be a revolution at some point and I'll be replaced. But so since then, which is quite a few years ago, I'm the president of the Woodland Trust.
And what do you have to do as a president?
Well, I don't have to do a great deal, but yeah. I make the odd speech, a bit of fundraising. I planted trees, you know, in sort of ceremonial ways, sometimes even with a member of the royal family there, you know, to encourage things along. And no, if I say so best, it's quite a well-run charity. Mm. It's quite young as charities go. I think it started about 1972 with one guy who kept making a nuisance of himself somewhere in Devon, I think it was. He kept objecting to things that were destroying hedges and trees and everything. Somebody said to him, you know, you can't keep coming to these parish council meetings and county council meetings and getting involved. You should have your own charity, you're so keen. And he said, oh, okay. So he started the Woodland Trust, and it's since 1972, which is not a million years ago. It's, you know, become a national charity with lots and lots of, a certain amount of land and lots of woods, and encourages landowners to plant trees and to increase the tree cover of the country.
It's funny, isn't it, being asked to do those sort of things? I am the president president of a children's theatre group,
yes,
a charitable children's theatre group in Soham called Viva. And they are absolutely brilliant, and I love going there.
Yeah.
But it's a very small charity, but they've done extraordinary things. The man who runs it is a man called Dan Schumann, and he, a young man he was when he started it, and now he's you know, he's not so young.
Yeah.
But he's actually, in the last 2 years, raised enough money to build a theatre in Soham.
Oh, well done him.
I know, it's incredible. But I often feel like a complete interloper. I feel, you know, well, couldn't you get somebody famous to do this?
Oh.
But they seem to be happy with me going on and just messing about a bit. And
I'm sure you
well
could
done.
Take part in the plays and tell them about your time on the...
you haven't seen them. I'm not good enough.
The Globe
I'm not
Theatre.
Good enough, Clive. They wouldn't have me. I've tried. I've said, I'll sing. And they say, shut up.
I bet they don't. But it's another thing, when you're on the telly a bit, you do get asked to be normally a patron or a president. I try to only say yes to things where I think I can do something.
Yes, or to have a particular personal involvement in the thing, I think is the important thing. I wish that I'd been involved in a children's charity that did theatre when I was a small boy, rather than just singing on my own in my bedroom.
But
there we are. I think you should have a full tree, Clive.
Okay,
I'm
full tree.
I'm going to put in a glorious English oak.
Yes. It's sort of suitable because the Anderson family, it's a sort of Scottish family, has a sort of an emblem to go with it, and which is an oak tree, and it has a motto, stand sure, so which is kind of goes with a... Well, I suppose in Scotland we probably won't call it an English oak tree, but I know what you mean. It is a Quercus roba.
Lovely. So that's it. We've got two items left.
Two items left. Oh, yeah. Well, I wondered if I could take a radio with me. It may be a puzzling object for people to come across in 100 years' time. What is
True.
This thing? We might as well do... I mean, obviously, radios come in lots of shapes and sizes, but I think I'm a bit addicted to radio. So my wife bought me a little radio. So you have a... put earphones in and you have it in your pocket. So it means that even when I'm walking the dog or going for a run, assuming I went for a run, or at any time, I can always be listening to the radio. I know some people are like that with music. They're always listening to whatever music goes. But I like listening to the radio, people talking to me, a bit of news, could be a play, it could be a sports commentary, you know, anything like that. I like the sound of people gabbling away to me. So I'm a bit addicted to it, but I suppose since I do make radio programs, I suppose I'm a pusher of radio as well. So
yes.
I'm involved in the addiction.
Are you sort of a Radio 4 man or
I'm
or
a Radio
sport?
4, but I do stray onto Radio 5 Live as well if it's like for football commentary. So I rock between those two, really. And I even have it on quite often when I'm working. Sometimes I can't cope with a human voice and I have to go off to might be Radio 6 music or something like that. But I'm not as invested in music in that sense. So that makes it just sort of background noise.
So do you think then that, in fact, what we're doing is slightly killing the world of radio? We're doing a podcast, and in fact, do you think that might be the future of spoken word?
Well, it probably is, in the same way that nowadays people tend to watch series on Netflix or could be the Disney Channel or whatever, rather less than just switching on BBC One, going to BBC Two, Channel 4, whatever. Now, a lot of people, myself included, we've got loads and loads of channels, and somebody says, oh, you really ought to watch such and such a series, and you sit and watch all evening, maybe, technically five episodes, six episodes of a series, but that's almost irrelevant now. It's just a whole lot of content. And on a podcast now, you know, I do a chat show on Radio 4, Loose Ends, and we tighten it down to a 45-minute show, a couple of bits of music, mostly conversation, quite concentrated thing. But that's, in some ways, good. In some ways, it's a bit too quick. And you can do a podcast like this where there's a little bit more room to breathe because you can say, well, we can keep going for 20 minutes with this guest or we could do an hour. I mean, obviously, if you get the judgment right, you may put the listener off, but you don't have to stick to pre-constructed schedule.
No. And some of the most, the most popular podcast in the world, Rogan, I think it is.
Yes.
His podcast sometimes lasts for two and a half hours.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend making this conversation with me, but on for 2.5 But I think this is why I think for a time capsule, this might work quite well, because it's a it'll indicate, because it'll be a radio that you can see. Oh, you can get Radio 4, Radio 4 Extra, Radio 5 Live, Radio 4 5 Live Sports, always Radio 2, Radio 1. What are all these things? Why don't you just go straight to Mike Fenton Stevens' podcast? That's what you want to listen to. Or you know, those great Siri, they do some fantastic series about court cases.
It's a different world, isn't it? The world of actually saying, well, it's on at that time, yes, so I make myself available for that time. You know, of course, radio now are constantly pushing the idea of that you can hear a program again, listen again.
Yes.
Or you can listen to our podcast where we will sum up the whole thing. And in fact, you will hear an extended version of the program.
You can find us again on BBC Sounds. This is something I say every week constantly. But I like the idea that radio is quite a personal thing. I think, well, obviously you can sit and watch a television on your own, or you can even go to the cinema on your own. But mostly you do that in company with other people. But I remember from being quite young, I used to like to go and listen to, like, I mean, I've always been into comedy, so I'd go and listen quietly on my own to comedy programmes.
Yeah.
I can only really remember communal listening to the radio. Quite often my aunt came for lunch on a Sunday, and she liked listening to the radio, and she loved programmes like Round the Horn. Now, she was literally a maiden aunt, and I think... I don't know what I've no idea. You know, hello, Julian, hello, Sandy, those extended periods of camp comedy and an innuendo coming in. She was laughing away, and I never really got down to, do you know why that's funny? Why was this recorded as an appropriate thing to listen to over, or just before maybe Sunday lunch? And we're all chuckling away at these quite dirty jokes.
Well, traditionally, with the English comedy, you can be absolutely filthy. Yes. With innuendo, really filthy.
Yeah.
Look at Julian Clary.
Yes.
But it's only once got in trouble with it. You may well have even been there.
Worse than that. I was there, and I don't know why I realised it. The camera came to me as for a reaction. You're trying to work out, I know it's funny, but I don't know, is this going to be... Yeah. So you've got to look.
Where's your reaction?
I'm laughing,
really,
but I'm shocked. But Julian is a nice guy. I'm not going to.
No.
Yeah. I think that caused him quite a lot of trouble, didn't it? But he came through it.
I don't know why, because I suppose because he was there, Lamont.
So yes.
It was a different thing. But that is, it's not really innuendo, is it?
Well, I don't know. He said, "I'm good. I've been fisting Norman Lamont," which is, was a bit. And then he said, "Talk about a red box," which I think was an unnecessary little addition to that. But that's in the moment he was, because it was the Comedy Awards that was at, and they, if you remember, they. There were always trouble at the Comedy Awards because everyone was kept waiting for a long while and given loads to drink and no food until afterwards, and a lot of raucous comedians in the room trying to outdo each other.
Yeah.
And it was interesting.
So I miss it, I have to say. I think if you're going to do comedy and occasionally you put everybody together in a room, it should be dangerous comedy.
Oh, yeah. So, and I'm plugging away with the idea of radio, and I wonder what your view is, Michael. It's your program, Radioactive.
Yes,
that was a big success on. And I know you do a sort of stage version of it now. But
see, you've done this interviewer thing, haven't you? You've turned it round now.
But I.
All right, I will answer your questions.
Some things work very well on radio. They look really well on radio, and comedy is a prime example of it.
Yeah. I think it's possible for podcasts to replace spoken word radio. I think it could happen. And it could got to the point where so few people are listening to Radio 4 that actually, why not?
Hmm.
And you can get all the news and everything you want so instantly now in all sorts of ways.
Yes.
That the idea of having to tell you the news every hour on the hour, again, could become outdated, I think.
Yes.
Maybe. I think it is a shame because I like the rigour of the half-hourly slot. I think I'm probably more rigorous with this podcast than many people are with podcasts.
Yes. The one thing I would say, the only thing I don't like about radio is they often interrupt things and say, we're going to go for the traffic report or the weather report. And it just as, they've got the Pope on there just about admit he's about to invade Venezuela. So, I'm sorry, Your Holiness.
And I'm going to have to stop you there.
I drive around quite a bit, and I don't ever remember getting an indication of a traffic jam that was any use to me on the radio. That's a thing for local radio to do, because it's well worth saying on a local thing, oh, look, the high street's blocked by a water main that's burst, so go around the other way. But saying, oh, and there's a blockage on the M something you've never heard of, another one down in Cornwall, and in Hampshire. No, but this is no good to me. What's happening on the M25?
No use at all. Yeah. And not only that, without a doubt, your sat-nav will be reacting more quickly than they will be by getting the information, the waiting to their sort of half-hourly slot and then telling you about it.
Yeah. I mean,
they never mention a traffic jam you're sitting in, do they, on the radio?
No. And if you are sitting in it, it's too late anyway, isn't it? The M1 is blocked just outside Luton. Yes. It certainly is.
I could have told you that an hour ago.
Still.
Yes, it's very true. Well, but, you know, I like the idea that you'll put a radio into the time capsule and that actually people will open up the time capsule in the future and wonder at it. Think
they're going to be puzzled.
Why didn't they put pictures with this? Why can't you see anything? What's the point of just having voices? Do you think that will disappear?
Well, I don't know. I suppose you could put any bit of technology into this time capsule. The things that we... I mean, I'm speaking to you via, I've got a microphone plugged into a MacBook. Yeah. And, you know, this, I don't know how long I've had it. It's just people look and say, oh, about time you upgraded that, isn't it? I think, well, I've only had it about 5 years. But so if this time capsule is going to be picked up in 100 years' time, it'll look so weird.
Yes.
And you won't be able to access anything on it because the software will have been forgotten.
Occasionally, these things turn around. I'm going to take you back to law.
Yes.
I have a friend who worked as a solicitor for British Telecom.
Yeah.
And he was put in charge of selling all the old tubes that ran all over London. And they had been used as a sort of air compression system of sending capsules between major offices around London. It was a system set up by the Victorians. An extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
You know, you'd put this thing into the tube.
And then you have to blow really hard.
Yeah, and then you blow really hard and hope it goes to the right office.
Old-fashioned shops used to have something like that, didn't they?
Yeah, they have them in shops, didn't they? But anyway, this was all over London. Mm. It had only existed for a few years and then become redundant, but it was still owned by British Telecom. And to dig it all up was going to cost them a fortune, so they decided to sell it. And they sold it for very little money. And then Wireless and Cable, who bought it from them, fed all their fibre optic cables through these tubes and saved themselves a fortune.
Yes.
Well, just to preserve it then, absolutely, we should put radio, which has been important in both our lives, into the time capsule. And so we've got one final thing, and I'm afraid this is something that you would like to be rid of, really.
Well, it's unfashionable to want to get rid of this, but it's a bicycle. But it's not any bicycle. It's the bicycle I was riding when I was 11, when I had quite a bad road accident.
Yeah.
It was nobody's fault but my own. And irritatingly, the bicycle was undamaged. And once I recovered, I rode it afterwards. And it didn't put me off bicycling, although I advanced to motor bicycling, which was much more exciting. But at the time, I had a bad cycle accident.
What happened to you?
It was the summer holiday between primary school and grammar school. Mm. And my father was away for a week. He went away once a year for a week. And I don't know how you found this, but I think one parent being away from a two-parent household, something always goes wrong while that one parent is away. Anyway, unusually, we decided to have fish and chips for lunch. Normally, we might have only occasionally ever had that, but it would be an evening thing. But for some reason, my mother said, all right, because she didn't drive, so we didn't have a car. I would cycle off to the shops to get the fish and chips. And of course, when you start doing that, oh yeah, while you're there, get a loaf of bread. And so I wasn't overladen, but I had a few things on my... So I was cycling home, happy as Larry. It was a summer day. And I think what I did, and this sounds ridiculous, but it was one of these bicycles, you had a gear change, a Sturmey Archer three-gear thing on my right hand. And I leant over, because I was carrying things, I leant over with my left hand to change gear.
Yeah.
And that sent me across in front of a guy, an oldish man, and a couple driving, I think a Morris 1000. in no way was their fault, but I don't think they stopped very quickly. So I was dragged along the ground.
So they hit you? They did hit me.
They hit me in the face. It damaged my teeth. I had a big injury to my knee, and it scraped all the skin off my back. Yeah. But strangely, none of my clothing seemed to be destroyed in this process. And I said the bicycle was also all right, but I was quite considerably damaged. But when I sort of, people turned up and they all screamed, poor little kid getting knocked over. Mm. I was only concerned about my teeth because I had a friend who'd had his teeth damaged. So I thought, oh no, God, I'm going to have those, a chip in my teeth now. But yeah. And they said, well, what's the, how are you feeling? I said, well, my knee, it hurts a bit, but I had a scab on my knee. I might have knocked the scab off. But I think I had 15 stitches in this huge gaping wound. And the skin was all scraped off my back. So they got me into the ambulance and took me to the hospital. And they said, I know, we've got some special stuff here. It's like plastic skin. We'll spray this over your thing. And it was really a real stingy pain when they sprayed it on. Oh, we've got to x-ray you. So roll over like that. And all this stuff came off on the bed. And then they sprayed it on again. And then they wheeled me to the ward in a gurney or whatever we call them in this country. And as soon as I got to the ward, the people there said, what's this stuff on your back? It's plastic skin. They've just sprayed. They shouldn't have done that. That's going to take that. And so the rest of the time I was in hospital, they used to sort of, it was like plasters being pulled off. They were pulling the skin off. But that was just, an unpleasant time. But like all these things, actually more unpleasant for everybody else than it was for me, because I didn't have to look at my back with its weeping skin. And the only trouble is my teeth have caused endless trouble. I've had to, had to have a crown put on it, and then that got replaced. And there's been endless troubles with my teeth as a result.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask the important question. How were the fish and chips?
Nobody got the fish and chips.
No.
And you're the only... Oh. That's a good question, because nobody's ever asked me that. So they would have done my... Oh, dear.
What a waste, honestly.
All these stories I know are really interrelate, because I was talking earlier about this football my grandparents in Scotland had sent me. And by the time I was about 11, my grandfather, then my grandmother died, and I had to deal with that because my mother was ill. And she was still ill at the time of having this accident. She had a problem with her heart, which, so it's not ideal if you've got a bad heart.
No, the phone rings. I know you were expecting lunch, but...
So she had to put up with that. And then now I'm thinking about it, I think then later on, when I was, I suppose, more or less grown up, sort of in my early 20s, I used to ride around on a motorbike. So I can see now, with my sort of parent's eye view of the world, how distressing it must have been that this idiot son, who hadn't necessarily developed too much in his early, was now riding around on a motorbike.
Yeah, you think you would have learned your lesson.
But it's something I did when I was a barrister. I used to ride around on a bike because you'd get to court here and there.
It makes sense in London.
Yes.
It's so much quicker. But then, it's quite quick on the tube, I have to say.
Yeah.
My father used to cycle. My mother and father, I think, sort of courted by going on bicycle rides out to the countryside. And my father, when we eventually moved out to the area that they used to go cycling to, which is probably the reason why we moved there, every time we went down this very steep hill, my father would tell me that that's the hill that he'd crashed his bike on.
Yeah.
And apparently his brakes failed. And at the bottom was a very sharp turn, and he couldn't turn. So he hit the hedge and went over the hedge onto the roof of a shed.
Oh, that's unlucky.
And all he remembers is that the woman who lived in the house shouted to her husband, George, it's happened again.
Oh, dear.
So there we are. All right, I'm going to put that undamaged bicycle.
Yes.
It's so unfair.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that undamaged bicycle into the time capsule, and we're going to lock it away, and you'll never have to risk riding it again.
And if you could find the jeans I was wearing, they were under. How you can have a 15-stitch wound in your knee...
I have no idea.
But through trousers, I don't know.
No, I've only ever come off a bicycle or a motorbike once. I came off a moped, which is no sort of great shakes. But yes, I was testing it out to see if I wanted to buy it, and it was quite late at night. And I had been drinking.
Ah, yes.
And I reached a roundabout, had no idea of how to control a moped or what speed I was doing, and I slid off it underneath a police car.
Oh, wow.
And the policeman got out and said, "You all right, son? Come here." "Oh, dear. No, that was nasty." Mm. And, of course, my trousers were completely torn, as was my leg. And he said, "Oh, that's just terrible. Oh, look at your bike." I said, "Well, it's not mine yet." What an idiot.
Yeah. Did you buy it or did you?
I did buy it, but I was done for driving without insurance or a license.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Yes. My one time in court. Not a good thing for a law student, I have to say.
I eventually got rid of one of my motorbiking days. I sold my last bike to my next door neighbour. He used to help me fix it from time to time, and he was fixing it. And then he said, "Oh, I'd quite like to buy this." And I said, "Yeah, I'll think about it," because it was, you know, the cold winter. And then I was in a car, and he hurtled up to me very, very urgently and said, "I want to buy a bike." and okay, yeah, so I think, no, I want to buy it now. And he produced the money in cash, and I could not quite work out why it was so necessary for him to buy. There must have been some reason he'd been stopped on it, or he wasn't, and he had to acquire ownership of it to justify his insurance policy. I was like, I'm happy. And I didn't think then that was me giving up motorcycling. I thought I'd get a better bike, but I never did. So
that was it.
That was it.
That was the end of it. Well, that's probably why you're still here today.
It's quite possible.
I should think. Well, there we are, Clive. Thank you so much for talking to me on My Time Capsule. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope I haven't rambled on too much.
Well, I hope you have rambled on too much.
You can edit it down to 5 minutes. It might make it.
Yeah, 5 minutes, I'll be lucky.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, but mostly my guest, Clive Anderson. In fact, you may have stopped listening to My Time Capsule. Unless you're a poor judge of comedy and like the occasional quirky outro that I do. Still, before that, I have to tell you that you can subscribe to this podcast to stream all episodes for free on Acast or your own favourite podcast provider. If you have the time, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate us and write a short review. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. For all the latest about My Time Capsule, you just search at MyTCPod, or you can follow me at Fenton Stevens. My Time Capsule is a cast-off production. The producer was John Fenton Stevens, and the music was by Pass the Peas Music. Thanks for listening, especially the very dear Roger Povey. And if you want a personal thank you, all you need to do is to retweet every post about My Time Capsule, like my mate Roger does. Thanks, Roger. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.